Okay, good evening. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out. I'm going to call the May 2011 meeting of the WMATA Riders Advisory Council's order. Appreciate you all being here. Our first order of business is public comment. Are there any members of the public?
Bill, you're on.
Good evening, all. I have no way of knowing if there's anybody on the Riders Advisory Council that has made any attempt to continue liaison with anybody on the TPD's Citizens Advisory Committee. But I've raised an idea with a few of you and with several of them in the hope that there would be reestablished some continuing connection, an idea about a letter for the Administrator of General Services Administration, calling upon her to make the final two appointments to the Board of Directors, both alternates. Well, it's partly new now because last Thursday, Mr. Dean Coley announced that he's now an alternate member of the Feds and no longer a PC. But I would like to suggest that the ideal still has merit in my mind if anybody cares to work with the CAC or TPD. And I've got a letter from the GSA administrator stressing that the one remaining representative should fulfill Tom Davis's original suggestion that he or she be a regular person as opposed to people now providing the board of measure. Not only a regular rider, but a regular person, reflecting the everyday rider's interests and concerns. So I'd like to restate that suggestion more to the full council rather than just the person of you, and hopefully we'll take that up. On another matter, very quickly, this past Friday, that's in the third month in a row, in which I was denied the opportunity to attend the JCC. This, however, was a little bit different from the previous few months. I was not arrested. I think something worse happened, and that is that Federal Police chose to ignore me effectively, which is much worse than being arrested. I would like, in your discussion with the Board's Governance Committee, that you attend to what I believe has been established, that the JCC is and should be a public meeting, if only to listen and not to talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Are there any other members of the public who'd like to speak? Okay. We'll now go to the approval of the agenda. Are there any objections to the agenda or any additions, corrections? Accept the agenda approved. Approval of past meeting minutes. John sent these out this afternoon. Did everyone get a chance to review them enough that we could go to approving, or do you want to hold off until next meeting to approve this set?
Motion to approve.
Okay. All in favor?
This can be a separate correction, but on the last page it says three paragraphs at the bottom. It says Mr. Kitchen, not that I'm in the PC, I think it's a little place where you did.
Thank you.
I'm sure that can be fixed if we can approve it.
Any other discussion? All in favor? Any opposed? Abstentions. Lorraine and David abstain.
Okay.
Okay. Well, now we have two presentations this evening. You remember from last month we had a presentation on principles about bus reductions. So this month we have someone who's going to talk about proposed rail service reductions. Mr. Jim Hughes, who is the director of intermodal strategic planning for Metro. Grateful that you are able to be with us tonight, Mr. Hughes, and you might begin by explaining your title.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jim Hughes. I'm the Director of Intermodal Planning, and I do the coordination between our rail and our bus service. Regular bus and rail integration, and also all of the integration we do when we do our major rail rehabs, and we're shut down and run shuttles all over the place and do all the coordination for those efforts also. But I'm here tonight specifically to go over the rail proposals that are out there in conjunction with our public hearing process and our public hearings that are coming up. But it won't take very long, but I thought it would spend 2 minutes to tell you how we developed and where we got to the weekend rail lightnings. A lot of people would ask that question. As the general manager proposed this budget, December to November, he proposed no service reductions at all. And proposed that the jurisdictions somehow find more funding to keep our service whole. During the 3 month processes we were going through our board and what to do with the budget, we were asked to develop some proposals. We went through, for the rail perspective, we went through all the proposals that were out there last year, which amounted to about $27 million. And they ranged from changing of hours of operation, opening later on Saturday and Sunday, closing later on Friday and Saturday, opening later on weekdays. They had a lot of mezzanine closings where we would close certain mezzanines at certain stations on weekends. And they included a lot of headway widenings from middle of the day, evenings, weekend headway widenings. They all went to public hearing last year. We also looked at some changes in our service patterns. We've extended the red line goes to Shady Grove all day long, all weekend long, as we turn back to Grosvenor. The extension to Fort Totten, where we used to turn around Mount Vernon. We had all of those on the table. We sort of narrowed it down from what we think is the least impact on the rail riders. And the proposal in front of you is to widen headways on the weekends. And the headway widening doesn't take anything away. Everybody can still make their trip by transit, whereas changing the hours of service or something would take something away from somebody. So we focus more on the headway widening. We also focus more on weekends because we have less ridership on weekends. And we also have, in the past 6-9 months now, almost a year, come June, done a lot of our track work on weekends. We're doing single tracking almost every weekend on the red line now. We're doing single tracking almost every weekend on the blue and orange line now. And as we do that single tracking, in order to get the trains through that single track, we are always widening headways. This past weekend, we had a headway widening on the red line, both ends of the red line, through most of the weekend. So we've been doing a lot of this. And we've noticed that our ridership pattern hasn't changed that much. More so when we do a segment shutdown, and we force people off to get on a shuttle bus. But a lot of our track work, we're able to take a segment of track, a single track, during that, keep all the stations open, and change the headway slightly so that if everybody can get to the station, they get on the train, get to the final destination, and continue on the train. And that is the proposal that is been approved and brought for public hearing. Slightly back as mentioned by the chair, last month you heard the bus one. This is the only rail. In your package on page 13 is the one page from the docket that describes the rail headway widening. And I won't go through all the lines, but I'd like to explain to you what's on this page. Top part is Saturday, bottom part is Sunday, and we do it by all of our lines and by time of day. So just go through the first maybe couple of lines. The red line today has a headway of 12 minutes. It starts at 7 a.m. It runs to 10 a.m. We run from end to end every 12 minutes. In the beginning, about 10 a.m. downtown, We then also start running from Shady Grove to Silver Spring on the 12-minute headway. What we're proposing to do is the second slash thing. So we presently open at 12, run that 12-minute headway to 10 a.m. We're not proposing to change that. Beginning at 10 a.m., running through the meat of the day from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., we now run those two segments, the long one, Shady Grove by one, the short one, Shady Grove to Silver Spring. We run every 12 minutes, and we're proposing to widen that to running every 18 minutes. What that means downtown today, you have a 6-minute headway. Standard Metro Center, Red Line train schedules go by every 6 minutes, and we're proposing that to be changed every 9 minutes. Table's kind of confusing, that's why I'm going through all this. Similarly, 6 p.m. to 9:30, trains from the long trains run every 15 minutes, the short range trains run every 15 minutes. Downtown is about a 7.5-minute headway. We're proposing to widen that to every 9 minutes. And then after 9:30 at night on Saturday, we run the red line from one end to the other, Shady Grove to Glenmont, every 15 minutes. We're proposing that to be widened to every 20 minutes. Similarly, the other four lines run the same headway. They start at a 15-minute headway, beginning at 7 a.m. for 10 a.m. We're proposing widen that to every 18 minutes. Middle of the day, and each of the four lines, blue, orange, yellow, and green, operate every 12 minutes. We're proposing to widen that to 18 minutes. And again, on the downtown segments, the headways today are half of that. So where the blue and the orange line come together, downtown presently is a 6-minute, we're proposing a 9-minute headway. Throughout the day, the headways are the same. I won't go through the rest of the chart. It's in front of you. Either I did a good job explaining it, or I didn't do a good job explaining it. And you'll ask a lot of questions. If we implement this change, our subsidy will be reduced by a total of $6 million on an annual basis. There is some ridership loss in there. We're assuming there'll be about 4 to 5% ridership loss on weekends if we do this all the time. But the net savings is $6 million. It's going out as part of the public hearing process. It would come back to the board. If the board approved to do this, we would not implement it until the end of September. We know all the numbers that Jim gave you last month, and I'm giving you an annual number, but it would only take effect for 9 months of this year or 9/12. So that's why how we got to this proposal. That's what the proposal is. And I hope I explained it well enough that I can entertain questions. How'd I do?
Very well. Thank you. Instead of going around the room, because we don't have time for everyone, we'll just ask you to put up their complaints and we'll meet the queue. Deborah was first.
Yeah, I have a question.
Scott,
I've been here. I have a question for you. Sound like you're looking for a way to save money and make it time convenient for everyone to ride the thing on the day of the week. And you might want to consider, I would love to close it down, move it close it up or close it and make it. I agree because if sometimes I don't see station managers sitting in their kiosk on some rental station. I agree that we do see the workers there because they're not only making sitting in the kiosk or something.
I can just very briefly, we did look at reducing numbers of station managers, where we have stations with a number of entrances, we have a person in every one. We looked at the option for having one station manager that would cover both entrances and do some of the things that you suggested. And it did not make there are some security issues we have related to that. And now is not the time to be looking at that type of thing. But those are the types of comments that we're trying to get from the public meeting.
I have Paul, Stephen, Chris, Schmidt, Ron, Kelsey, and so Paul.
Thank you for coming. I think this is a very rational proposal that doesn't place too much burden on riders. Obviously, it's not an ideal situation, but there is a shortfall in your budget. Has there been any weighing of why stations aren't closed outright? I can't imagine that more than 50 people get on and off at Judiciary Square on the weekend. Or I'm sure that you could point to a variety of stations that have extremely low ridership and are also within easy walking distance to other stations. Usually they have even better service in the case of this one, the other place.
Again, last year we looked at closing stations. Judy Square was one of them, for instance, and Chevrolet and a couple of underutilized stations. And when we went out to public hearing, it was clear from the public comments they did not want us to do that. So because of where we are from a budget situation and not trying to reach that far, we did not make this proposal. So,
does this factor in special events such as Nationals games, Caps, Wizards? I mean, there are periods of heavy activity. I do remember once leaving a basketball game and standing, waiting at least a half an hour at Metro Center to get to Franconia Springfield. I mean, is this just sort of hard and fast, or is it reacting to situations and throughout the course of the year, such as in April, during the cherry blossoms, the ridership is tremendous to people out of town, and these type of headways will make these stations potentially nightmarish at various times.
It's not generic across the board. When we have special events, was captain or something, we actually run extra trains before and after the game, and that's not factoring here. We would continue to do that. For open day, we ran 14 extra trains on for the cap games. We would continue to do that for a large crowd, less of a crowd. But this is the generic what the public would see on a day in and day out, week out basis.
Okay, Ron?
I'm focusing in on Saturday in particular. My experience has been that going downtown on a Saturday, even when it's single tracking, the trains aren't that crowded. It's not a problem because people go downtown at different times. But around 11 o'clock or midnight on Saturday, when everybody's getting out of concerts and plays and movies and bars and everything else, the cars are extremely packed. And I'm wondering, how have you considered that? In other words, do you know the numbers of people that currently crowd onto the train, say between 10 p.m. and 1 a.m., and what the projection will be? A couple of times I've gone downtown recently, it's been very crowded on those trains. I can't imagine if you string this out even more that you're not going to have overcrowding late at night. So I was wondering, what are your numbers?
We have numbers of entries and exits for the station for half-hour period, 15-minute period, actually. What we don't have necessarily is it by train. So we know that they're coming into the station and they get off it. They get on an Orange Line station, get off an Orange station. We can predict what train they're getting on, but we can't always do that. If they're getting on a place and they're going to Roslyn, they could be on any train that comes in.
Are you going to try to measure that? Because it seems like that's an important measurement.
We've measured the late night trains, the very late ones, which people after 10 o'clock, after 11 o'clock, and then closer to 12, those less trains get, some of them get crowded. As I said, when we have events, we run extra trains, and we will continue to do that. We are looking at whether or not those last trains, we're doing some more counts now that the weather is nicer. Because it impacts it, to see whether or not late at night we've been on 8-car trains. We think there's enough capacity out there. We're going to double check to see whether or not we've been on longer trains.
Kelsey?
Thank you for the presentation. My question is, I don't think I heard this as you were speaking earlier, but what happens on the red line on Saturday and Sunday between 7 and 10 a.m. that there is no proposed change in the headway? And I guess, have you done any estimates of if you add, 3 minutes or 5 minutes for a proposed headway, what would the annual subsidy savings mean then?
Saturday? Saturday morning?
Saturday morning and Sunday. Those were, I know Saturday and Sunday morning, the red lines don't have any proposed headway changes.
We have, for those two times, early in the morning on the red line, we again only operate the longs, we don't have the shorts. So everything from end to end is now 12 minutes. And we didn't want to, when we looked at the ridership early in the morning, those first couple trains carry a lot of people. People going to work that tied their work around the first trains that are leaving in the morning. And to widen that higher, we thought that that would be an impact. We wanted to keep it at the 12 minutes and at the 15 minutes on that line, because that line is heavier ridership than the other four lines.
Wow. I guess as a follow-up, I would just ask that you consider adding the 3 minutes if, you know, the whole region is feeling pain cost-wise and having to adjust to LaMotta's new schedule. Certainly there are people on the Green Line and the Pullman Line that take Metro to get to work as well during these hours on Saturday and Sunday morning.
I will bring that comment back just from a technical standpoint, however, what went to the public hearing. At this point, we can recommend something that's significantly different than that, has less for the customers. So I'd have to get an actual ruling on that, but I'll bring that back.
Okay, Chris Schmidt, Penny, and Dawn, and Penny.
Yes, hi, good evening. I just have a question on bus versus rail. You know, you talked rail now, we heard bus earlier. When you get to the end of the day, how does the relative cut between, proposed cut at least, between bus and rail compare? Are they shouldering something of an equal burden, or is one proposed to go down more than the other?
Actually, the $6 million subsidy reduction on the rail is a little bit more than the subsidy reduction on the bus. The bus had more cuts into them, but there was some investment, reinvestment on the bus in terms of their quality of performance. We didn't necessarily look to try to balance it one way or the other, but once you start touching the railroad, it's either a lot, either a big expense or a big savings. So they're both relatively minor. But the bus one ended up being less because some of it was reinvested to keep some of the lines into a better long-term performance than the present we have.
Ron?
Thank you for coming and making your presentation. I just have one comment, and I know it's not anything you can control, and that is during the last fair release, there was a lot of talk about Metro Rail customers and Metro Bus customers getting hit hard. And it's true that Metro Bus customers and also people riding the peak of the peak got above inflation rate increases. However, off-peak riders were, while they did see an increase, it wasn't a great increase. So I would really have rather seen an option for fare increases to stave off these service cuts so the riders could weigh in. But having said that, now that this is what's before the public hearing and all that can be considered, one of the things I would be interested in doing, knowing is benchmarking. Metro Rail is the second largest rail system in the United States by ridership. I believe the other large ridership systems that would compare with Metro would be Chicago and New York. And how do these headways compare with the headways in Chicago and New York? I was in Toronto last winter, which is why I bring up this suggestion. I was actually catching the train and bus back to the airport. I dismissed the train. There was a train on Sunday afternoon, 5 minutes later. So I would think that these, and without checking the schedule, I couldn't say that these headways would put Metro at very sparse headways compared to systems that you would benchmark against.
I think we've done some of that, and if we have, I'll give it to John. He can circulate that as part of the minutes.
Sure. Got it.
As a follow-up to Dawn's question, actually, I'm sure you've done analysis as well on the impact of people who aren't just going on one rail line and ending their trip on the same rail line, people that are doing transfers to other rail lines or to bus, how this might impact the time, the total time that their trip takes. My sense is that it could have a very great impact on the total time of their trip, but what is your sense from your analysis?
We don't think it's going to have very large impact, except for maybe after 9:30 at night, where it gets warm enough. A lot of our traffic is in the downtown area. You can transfer in front of Red Line for Blooming Arms on. So if you look at the sheet in a headway downtown, it's going from 6 minutes to 9 minutes. Even if you're transferring from that line to another line that has a headway from 6 minutes to 9 minutes, you could be increasing your overall trip, you know, 3 to 6 to 9 minutes, depending on exactly how you meet that transfer. Just walk in the station and miss a train and then do a transfer and just miss the next one. Most of the time you're adding 6 to 9 minutes to your trip. Then at night that gets higher because you're going from a headway that's downtown headway that's 10 minutes to a downtown headway that's 25 minutes, and later at night we get people going to the end of the line and just miss the last trip and like that. There could be significant waits. And then this train, the next one's 25 minutes out to the end of the line. It's 20 today, but that 5 minutes late at night seems like an awful long trip. I've been through there late at night, and those are the most crowded trains, even if we put 8-car trains in there. And we do meet the last trains, so they sit a while for the last trains. But we've got to do everything we can to keep that up there. And again, to go back to what I mentioned earlier, we are doing a lot of this on the weekend as we're doing track work. As we do track work on the red line and we widen the headway up to 20 minutes, people are seeing that now. And we haven't seen a large impact on ridership.
Thanks. When you present this to more people, I would. One suggestion is you might be sensible to make another line that shows combined blue orange and combined yellow green, because it's not immediately obvious here. For example, at the 7 to 10 a.m., the red lines have a 12 minute headway, but as you said, the blue orange combined is a 9 minute. And that doesn't jump out at you necessarily, that actually the red line has the worst headways of any of the sort of central sections, so the peripheral sections of one line would be lower. And so to sort of make that more clear, to other folks as well. And just wanted to point out to the question that Kelsey raised, I think that's a good question. So I would note that the red line going from 15 to 20 means it gets 33% worse, whereas the others would get 25% worse, so it's actually got a worse headway widening at the one end and then a less worse at the other end. So.
Ms. Hughes, thank you for your presentation, for answering our questions, and preparing us for our budget discussions.
Thank you.
Next item on our agenda is a presentation on Metro Board Governance and Bylaws by two of our newest members of the Board of Directors, Mary Hines and Kathy Porter. So, would you like to come up, maybe right here? Mary?
Right here. Okay.
And sure. Kathy, just next to you. I sort of lost my head in. I'll just give you a brief introduction of Ms. Hines and Ms. Porter. Ms. Hines joined the board as a principal director representing Arlington. She is a member of the Arlington County Board since November of 2007 and currently serves as the vice chair. She has been on the Arlington School Board, and she participates in the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments on the aviation policy. She's the aviation policy liaison. For the fourth year, she continues to represent Arlington on the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission. And Ms. Porter will be joining us shortly. Joined the board also in January of 2011 as an alternate director for Montgomery County. She served on the Tacoma Park City Council for 6 years and was the mayor of Tacoma Park for 10 years. She has represented Tacoma Park on the Washington Transportation Planning Board and served as the chair of that board. She also chaired the Transportation Planning Board's Access for All Committee, which had the task of bringing representatives from disadvantaged groups into the transportation planning process. So So we are very happy to have our two new board members with us, and we'll ask you to make a little presentation and then maybe open for questions.
Well, thank you very much, Frank, and thanks for having me. I know I saw Kathy appreciate it.
You were just introduced.
Thank you. So I'm going to walk you through. You have three documents in your packet that represent what we've been working on. The first one, and begins on page 15 to 74, is the bylaws. And if I might, we've been characterizing the bylaws as sort of our governing rules that are written in concrete. We're trying to put into these things that we think shouldn't change very often and shouldn't change without a lot of conversation. The second document, which is on page 31 of 74, are the procedures. And quite honestly, the procedures are, you're familiar with the fact that the board had procedures before. So what we've been doing is going through that old procedure document and deciding what really belongs in bylaws and what can be more flexible and you might want to look at every year and make some small adjustments to. So while bylaws are in concrete, I think of the procedures as being in erasable ink. But again, lots of conversation before you really make that change. The third document, then you have a set of questions on page 39, which I'm going to pull mine out because I'm really hoping we'll have some conversation around those after I walk you through a little bit. And then beginning on page 41 is this chart thing. When we got everybody's various recommendations about governance, and we brought to the table also the work that many of us as board members in other places understand about how good governance works, we sorted the recommendations into categories, and we created initially a one-pager that had these categories and how we thought we kind of summed it up. What this chart currently does is for instance, under A, rotating chair. When you get over to the status, it tells you how we handled it in either the bylaws or the procedures, or in one or two cases, there's a reference to the code of conduct. So it allows you, if you're interested in a particular area, to go look at it and go back then into the documents and see the context and the wording that we use to try to resolve it. So that's what those three things are. The last thing I want to say, and we did look very, very carefully at the work that you all did to produce the report, and let me say thank you. Thank you very much for adding your voice. You added a really important perspective to the conversation, and if you had not done that, some of the things we're taking up, we would not be taking up. So, kudos to you for taking the time and doing that. A number of the things that you cared about the most in your report are actually right now being talked about in the context of procedures. So if you read through the bylaws, you were disappointed, you didn't see anything, the procedures are still a work in progress, they're only about halfway through. One of the questions, actually one or two of these questions on the discussion page go right to the heart of the issues that you all raised. So we're still working on that, and I'm happy to share with you kind of where we got last week. But from a very large point of view, I think it's important to say that we haven't taken 100% of what anybody told us. You got 14 people on this board with many, many years of working in many, many venues who are, I think, bringing their best thinking about what makes for good governance to the table and negotiating among themselves about how we're going to do our work. And we know that we're not going to make everybody who wrote a report happy on every aspect. But we're here tonight because we want to know where you think we missed it, and we want to give you the opportunity to make a strong case for something that you think we should pay attention to. And the timeline, just so you know, is the bylaws are, the plan is for them to be out from now until the board meeting in June. June the 23rd, I believe, is when the actual board meeting is. We'll probably have our last conversation as a group on June the 9th, when the committee meets. And then we'll take everything we've heard and try to get to a document we might approve at the end of June. We might slide till July. I'd be lying if I didn't say that. But we really would like to try to get this finished up in June. We have more things. We have strategic plans and strategic planning work and a bunch of other things that the committee needs to also, that we are also responsible for. So just that's the timeline. So you're welcome to think of tonight as a first conversation. And if you want to put some written comment together and get it to us, you know, you could do it by the end of May, that'd be great. If you could do it the first week of June, we'll obviously take it, because that would still let us amalgamate it on June 9th. But we really are extremely interested in what you have to say. So, Kathy, do you want to, is there anything you want to add to what I said? We haven't done the tag team before.
So I think that covers it. I just want to reinforce Mary's comments that we really do want to hear from you. You all obviously put a lot of thought and effort into the plan and the comments that you gave us, and we would really be interested to hear what your reaction is to what we have.
So rather than kind of delve into detail, do you want me to walk through it? I'm assuming that you all looked at it and have had some time to think about it, so I don't think we all need to waste our time in writing other stuff. So the three issues that have been teed up on this page 39 are things where the other committee members said to me, please make sure that you get the Writers Advisory Council's reaction to these particular things. So if you don't mind, can we go through those three? And then we'll be happy to take notes and field questions on anything else that people have. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. So this first one, communication with the public, is in the bylaws, I believe. Carol, is in the bylaws, right?
Page 20.
Thank you.
At first glance, I'm not sure I love the idea, because
I think you raise a good point, and to lose the involvement if Ms. Hines is our liaison, what is the incentive for Ms. Porter to come and care and come to meetings and visit us? We've had a lot of good, not that either of you would ever feel in, but we've had a lot of good presentations over the years from a variety of board members. But I think most people around this table would feel pretty strongly if I said that the board member we see the most is the chair, and I can't say 90% of the other board members have ever even been in this room to talk to us in any capacity. There are probably exceptions. So I don't think codifying that is in the interest of the board-RAC relationship. You know, the members should have relationships with their board member from their jurisdiction, and then I think the RAC should have a relationship with the board members as a whole, regardless of jurisdiction.
We have Penny, Kelsey, and Deborah.
I think the spirit of the idea is a very good thing. I do want to say that if there were a liaison to the RAC or the AAC, for example, I would definitely want it to be a board member that self-selected as being in that role, that was truly interested in public involvement, getting working closely with the advisory groups. I think there may be some different views among board members on how important that is. So if this group were pursued, I just want to make sure it was someone who was really committed to it. And I would want to make sure that we still maintain our communication and relationships with our board members from our jurisdiction as well.
Kelsey?
Yeah, I think I agree sort of with what's been said before. I find that, I think while it might be a good idea, I don't think necessarily having a liaison is necessary. I see it as maybe adding another layer to our communication efforts. I think that the RAC, at least, I can't speak for the other groups, but that we're pretty good about knowing who on the board we need to address maybe certain letters to, or everyone, or we need to speak with. So I think it would only be effective if that liaison person is and how involved they want to be. And I think that's something that could vary year to year each time you appoint a new liaison. So I just I don't think it's needed at this time.
Amber?
I have a
question about who
the
man. If we use it as an item for discussion, and we use it to compare with bylaws what we have,
that's a great observation. I have not been back through the RAC bylaws to even think that's a great question and observation. And so it might in fact, maybe that's something you all might want to do and then give us your opinion on whether, I mean, I'm hearing a little, not sure we really need this, so it might be moot, but that's a great question.
I just want to comment on one comment that came up during your discussion at the committee last week about, during this section, Mr. McKay said that he felt that there was a certain amount of vagueness in terms of whether or not the board members had an open invitation from the RAC to attend any of our meetings. And so I think that it would be a good idea for us to clarify to you that, in fact, board members do have such an invitation. Talking to the officers, we can get everyone's input, but I think that we could perhaps say to the board formally that any member of the board is welcome to come to any of our meetings. If they are interested in being on the agenda, we would ask for some amount of advance notice so that we can structure the agenda around that. If any board member wants to simply come and listen or, you know, maybe comment during an agenda item or something, that we would certainly welcome that at any time. So, if people agree, maybe we can send a letter to the board saying that we think that.
And I'd also add on to that, any board members more than welcome to request a meeting with the Riders Advisory Council members from their jurisdiction, and perhaps they don't know that that power is within your grasp.
Perhaps even we should say that board members are encouraged to do that.
Yes.
Some members have
act with regularity, I think.
Right. Some members have sought out that opportunity, and some have not taken advantage of that.
Thank you. As I guess the newest entity reporting to the board as chair of the AAC, I would echo that too. I think that it's the feeling of our group also that we get 5 minutes to speak for the board. We present a report. That's one type of communication. But I think you get a better feeling for how a group is conducting, what the thinking is that goes into the various arguments that you make. And I certainly can speak for my group, AAC, when it comes to issues like metro access and the accessibility of the bus and rail, that sometimes a five-minute report doesn't do that justice. And I think listening to the thinking of the group and how they formulate their opinions is important. So AAC meetings are the first Monday of the month between 5:30 and 7:30, and you're certainly welcome. And I understand we'll be and some of this next month at AAC also.
Right, we're hoping to be at your meeting next month. Might I suggest on this issue of, I guess, maybe defining our relationship a little bit more clearly, that you all could look at Article 14 in the bylaws, which is page 28 of 74. In your article, or your paragraph B, section B, you know, we focus that very much on why we established the RAC, right, which was to get input and stuff. But you could suggest some language, either here in the bylaws that begins to talk about the jurisdictional relationship and the, on, you know, that board members can have a relationship with, you know, an ongoing presenting relationship or a conversation with the whole RAC. Or you could think about suggesting some language to that effect in the procedures. But I think it's an important idea not to lose. And as somebody who, you know, did call up my jurisdiction people and say, come talk to me so I can learn some things from you, but I do think it's not, it may not be totally clear to others if that's the case. And so let's find a way to put it in here, either in one of the two places. I think that's a great observation.
And actually the same is of the AAC,
right,
and we'll talk about that more when we meet with you all.
Right, so I think that if we're looking at language, like if we can make it generic for the two groups, divide both groups, I don't think there's going to be an issue with that.
Right, or we make it the same and put it in both paragraphs, since there are some much different ways around us. But yes, I think let's get that idea in here in some manner.
We move on to the second area.
You all had much to say about public comment and about committee meetings and other things, and we did have a lot of conversation. And again, I think we're on page 33. We're only through Article 3 in the bylaws. I don't know if I told you that. So we haven't talked about 4 on. But in Article 3, I think there is an openness to having certain kinds of public comment at committee meetings. Not this sort of what I would call non-agenda, like the start of our board meetings, but more focused, as well as the capacity for chairmen to invite in special people at particular points in time when they want a particular kind of feedback. So, you know, we're looking for ideas about how to make sure public comment and safety isn't about everybody who slipped on the tile last week because when we had a lot of snow, but is focused more on policy. And then what mechanisms might people have in mind that would let the public know that particular topics are the ones where we are, in fact, seeking public comment at a committee meeting? Because not everything would necessarily be germane for public comment that comes to a community.
And let me just add, in terms of a little bit of context, one of the things that is of interest to the board, particularly the new board members, is reducing the amount of time the board spends in the committee. And so, as a piece of what you're thinking about when you're thinking about how most effectively to fit public comment into committee meetings, keep that sort of in mind.
Yeah, we don't want to add half an hour to every committee meeting, necessarily.
Okay, I have David, Joseph, Paul, and Tyson.
Thank you. First, let me say I really appreciate the comments from both of you and a lot of your colleagues on the board at last week's meeting. There was a great openness to hearing more from members of the public about agenda items. I really appreciated the sentiment from Mr. Ewell shared by many people that about getting rid of the somewhat the kind of ridiculous rule about limiting people to only coming to the board once every 3 months. Just generally, there was a real sense from listening to the audio of people being very open to hearing more, and I think that was fantastic. Two areas I wanted to sort of react to based on that meeting. One was there was some discussion about sort of focusing on action items in the agendas, which makes a lot of sense. One comment is that I've observed that at committee meetings, there also seems to be this sort of information item that turns into kind of an action item, where the staff might be presenting something as an information item, but then they hear the reactions from the committee members, and then they go and modify their course of action that they end up recommending, or modify the analysis that they're going to do based on that input from you all. And I think it would be helpful for you to have the opportunity to hear feedback from the public before giving that sort of off-the-cuff guidance. It also is something we talked about in the report, that perhaps there should be a little bit less of a reliance on that off-the-cuff guidance, and maybe that's something you'll talk about at subsequent meetings, where maybe information items become more about information as opposed to sort of taking the temperature of the board in order for them to decide what to do. But that's another conversation that I guess you'll have. If there are those sort of taking the temperature items, you know, I hope that there can be an opportunity for comment. As far as the question about having the comment in the meetings, I think when we had written something about wanting a robust, you know, and participatory public input process, it doesn't necessarily have to be people speaking at the meeting. And I definitely appreciated what Mr. Nichols said about not necessarily wanting it to just be about the people that have the time to show up at the meetings, especially given that your meetings sometimes go very long. And that's, you know, and so, you know, I've sometimes gone and then waited 3 hours for, you know, the lunch, which was delayed 3 hours because of the previous meeting, and you know how it is. So getting the public input doesn't have to be in person, and perhaps it's even better if it's not in person. But what seems to happen is that sometimes agenda items just show up on the website just before the meeting. In some cases, if they do show up the Friday before, as they're usually supposed to, there isn't always all of the information that people might need to comment. And for people that don't know how to reach all of you, there isn't necessarily a clear way to comment, because the emails that go into the board of directors alias, you know, get assembled to that spreadsheet, but I'm not sure that that has the same impact in terms of being observed by the local jurisdiction member as, you know, as an in-person comment might be, or even as a direct personal email to the individual might be. So having some way to sort of make sure you actually do get the comments that might be made, you know, and maybe the ones at the meetings, you know, don't have to be for every comment, but there are also perhaps cases where someone might have a lot of, you know, information to really present. You know, maybe they've done a lot of analysis, maybe it's people from the RAC, you know, and it might be useful for, I know there was some talk about this, I think it's a good idea, for the RAC members, especially if there was a committee that looked at something, to make a presentation at that. At one point in the past, I think we were sort of told maybe we could, and then I went and did it. And then there was some vagueness between me and Lloyd and the committee chair about whether I was supposed to, and anybody started to clarify. But last comment was, you know, the RAC doesn't have the capacity to address every one of the items that's going to come before the board. So I wouldn't encourage you to go in a direction where you say, we'll only get the feedback from the RAC, you know, because we can't give you all the feedback that all the groups might. But certainly for some of the most important things, maybe one of our committees looked at that, and maybe, you know, talking more at a board meeting itself might be something that you were off is geared towards meeting or at committee activity or something of that nature.
Thank you, David. Joseph?
Good afternoon. I don't want to be too loud with David's head, which is what I was trying to say. But I do want to just say that, you know, I think opening up the meetings, committee meetings, or any sub-meeting of the board to more public comment is probably the best thing to do. That's where a lot of the decision is probably going to be made, even if it has to be ratified by the board, by the full board. By the time it comes to the board, it's probably going to happen. And so I think that waiting, having too many people wait till the board meeting just puts a lot of people feeling that even though you've thought about this for 3 weeks in between the committee meeting and the full board meeting, and now you have 50 people telling you not to do what you're about to do, they feel that you haven't listened to them because you've thought about this for 3 weeks and they're coming to comment now. And so I think that allowing that input up front, which is similar to what you say about your governing documents, the conversation's probably going to taper off around the 9th, but the vote's not going to be until the 23rd. And so allowing people to comment up at that time on the 9th is probably a way to have people feel like they're involved in the actual decision-making. And the only other thing that David didn't talk about that I did want to mention is the last bullet point. I think that distinction that you reach in between what type of comment you want is a healthy distinction that probably could help keep down some of the that type of comments that you are actually seeking. And so that you're actually not, probably won't be helpful, which is you want people to help you discuss policy and not help you oversee the system. And so I think that that's a healthy distinction. Some people may not see that. I already know three people who I know that will probably not do that as a healthy distinction, but I think it is a healthy distinction because you're probably going to be accessible to more information. You're going to be accessible to hearing a collective thought, not just my personal experience with the system. And so I think that one distinction right there could be a way to help distinguish between the type of comment that you want and the type of comment that might not be necessarily so helpful. I think that's it on this topic.
Thank you, sir. Paul?
This is one of the points that I went back and forth on quite a lot when we were working on this report. I think that you run a very large risk opening up an in-person public comment to not only extend your meetings half an hour, but hear about the last time someone slipped on the tiles and the other variety of issues that are unrelated to the policy discussions that will be going on. When there are hearings in Congress, you know, it's not public testimony. Well, you have invited guests, of course, to testify, but they're not open to public comment. The public gives their comment on what is going on in those hearings by contacting the representatives. Last time I checked, your role on the board was a public role, and people are encouraged to contact you and discuss matters of metro interest to you. And I would encourage the public comment if people feel strongly about what is being presented at committees. They have representatives on the board that from their region that they can discuss those issues with, raise questions with, schedule a meeting with, in whatever form that may be. But I think public comment at committee meetings presupposes that board members aren't available outside of those committee meetings to discuss things, and that's patently false. So I see it as something that isn't really necessary. And because for the variety of reasons listed, but, you know, I think you're going to get a lot of stuff that is not going to help. And I think, quite frankly, if people are interested in what the committee is discussing, the materials are posted online in some form, and, you know, you folks have emails, you folks have phone numbers, you folks have offices and ways for people to get in touch with you, and you know your communities. And, you know, that's why this is, that's one of the reasons I think the system works. And I think that requiring public comment before every meeting, you know, ignores that. Every committee meeting.
Thank you, Paul. Kelsey, any, Chris?
I have a couple of suggestions for the first two questions. The first question, how to structure the process so that comments are related to the item being considered by the committee. For that, I would say if you're going to open it up to public comment, I would suggest that you be very explicit with what it is that you want, and to even put examples out there or a list of topics that you're seeking comment on. What I find is that when people take the time to actually send in a comment or a complaint, they go in everything just because they feel like, well, I'm taking the time now to meet and to talk. Let me do that. But perhaps, again, be very explicit with what you want and give an example. Maybe that will give their comments some structure. The second question, speaking as a D.C. resident, this is something that gets to me not just here with WMATA board meetings, but through D.C. government meetings. I'd like to see the board, and maybe this happens, and I'm just not aware of it, accept comments via email, and perhaps for seniors or those who don't have internet access, to have some type of an automated messaging system that only allows them 5 minutes to list their name, their address, their number, and what their concern is, and then, you know, put it in an electronic format for some staff person to read and properly file. Also, here at DC, we have a number of neighborhood listservs that are tend to be very good about getting information out again to those people that have an email address and can get the information. Also, what I'd like to see is maybe if the board put out flyers on buses that had a very distinct color, so that way people can say, okay, every time I see that orange flyer, I know now that the board is asking for comments and I need to read this in case I'm interested in submitting a comment. And the other thing I said that the executive office of the mayor in D.C., he has contacts or public communication professionals for each board. So again, that's a way those people will then know how to push out, you know, how to seek in comments, push that out to all of their groups in the community.
Thank you. Chris?
Hi. I would just like to offer two observations if I could. First, I'd like to echo what Joseph said earlier, which is, if you have an option, opt for more open all the time, because this agency needs a lot more openness, and every chance you get, I think you should be taking. The second thing is, I would direct to the third bullet in your question thing, and that's the distinction made between policy development and oversight. I would strongly urge you to not rule out the oversight function as part of the comments. Again, just from what we know and what we learn every day, this agency is in dire need of more oversight. And so to choke off one potential avenue of hearing from things or hearing about things from people who are on the ground and can be in a position to point you toward things, I think would be a serious mistake. So thank you.
Penny? Thank you, Chris.
I'm reminded of something I learned from serving on a commission in Arlington, and that's how we handle the public comment process. There's, in the beginning, there's items that are not on the agenda. Obviously, you're not looking for those in a committee meeting, so don't do that. But having people sign up for to comment on the specific agenda items by agenda items, and then perhaps having them comment when that agenda item comes up, and obviously have the structured limited amount of time. I know as a person hearing public comment that that is more helpful for me to hear it at the time that I'm considering that item than at the beginning of the meeting. So that might be a way to structure it as well.
David?
I just had one more thought that I guess sort of was brought up by the, what Carl said. You know, to the congressional comparison, I think one of the nice things about local government sometimes is it can be a little bit easier to contact than Congress is. But the what I really wanted to say was that Carl made a really interesting point about talking about members being accessible outside of the meetings, and I think that that is very much the case with some members, including you two, and has not, in my experience, been the case with some other members, especially appointees who were never or are not elected officials. There are some DC members who, you know, I would email all the DC members from time to time, and some replied regularly, and there are some that never once replied to me, who do not have a publicly accessible way to contact them, who I'm not aware of them ever really reaching out to RAC members or to people who might have written into board of directors at WMATA.com about concerns that they would have. So, you know, if it's almost like one approach to getting a level playing field for everyone to reach all the members is to have them come where the members are all sitting at, in the room here, and talk to them. Another approach is to say, you know what, we're going to encourage that to happen offline, but we're going to require a certain amount of accessibility or set up a process for all the members to be accessible, to be reachable in a way that you know it's not just going to be on some spreadsheet they're never going to read, but that, you know, they will kind of be aware of the information, you know, to some extent. I mean, obviously, there's only so much you can do. So as long as, you know, people know what's going to be discussed, know how they can give input, have an opportunity to do that before the deliberation happens, and know that their comments will be heard by members, that could be in person or it could be through some other mechanism.
And I also want to thank you, ladies, for coming out. I've been to a number of public hearings, and some of the comments I hear from the participants, they don't understand that they can only give comments, no questions ever answered. I think sometimes that you really need to make sure people understand the ground rules. And I think it might be helpful to have some type of, you know, summarization of maybe what was said, did people provide their names and addresses to send them a note, because when they leave there, what happens to their comments? And that's the thing that I think that people are really concerned about, whether it's a policy issue or an oversight issue, whatever is important to that individual, that's what they're going to speak on. And I think, as Kelsey said, to try to, you know, get them a horn in on the specific topic at the committee. But I do think people need, and it doesn't have to be something, you know, like a dissertation or whatever, but some kind of summarization of the items that you think are important, not just what they said, but if 10 people gave public comments and three of them had ideas that you're going to consider, that should be in the summarization, you know. But I do clearly think that there need to be very distinctive ground rules so people are not, you know, disenfranchised, disappointed when they leave. To think that you could answer questions, you know, at that end. Thank you.
I'm going to put myself in the last question for this section, and then we'll have to move on for the last comment in this section. And that's to address bullet number two. I don't have any answers for that one, but I would encourage you to do more of it. I find, since being on the RAC for going on 3 years now, I learned so much about that Metro does have opportunities for public input, but that most riders don't even know about them. They just don't know about them. I started riding Metro regularly just about 4 years ago, and the first week I was on bus, there was a survey, and I thought, this is a great system, they're asking for our feedback. And I have never seen a survey since. I have never seen any announcement that there is such a thing as a Riders Council, that there are public board meetings, that, that the website has information and opportunities. There just, I think, needs to be a lot more communication on the opportunities that the public has. I think it's part of the board's, one of the things we talked a lot about in our discussions was the board's role as educators of the public about transportation. I think that's one. But I think we have to move on to number three.
Can I actually ask one question just together? The
the mechanics of getting more people to know that we're looking for comment is actually, it's a huge topic. And it might be a topic that's fruitful for a jurisdictional conversation, because Kelsey had ideas about structures she knows in the district. I don't know what Penny does about, you know, Virginia, I'm sure somebody else does about Maryland, but it might, that might be a good thing for us to talk about. But let me just ask you a really simple mechanical thing, okay? The agenda comes out, and it has, now, this would be a committee agenda. It comes out, and it has a list of things that you can click on and go to see the document, right? But one of the questions is, how do we let you know that we would like you, we really are interested in you telling us about B on the agenda, and, you know, A is the KPI report, and we're not going to take comment on that. So I'm just even wondering, is there some, you know, does it always have an asterisk, or is there a symbol that is on that agenda? You know, what words to sort of tell you? I mean, it's,
you're going to get answers.
I am very focused on the practical issues, too. So.
No, that's great. Sharon?
You could use, you know, I think you should just, you know, go with the banners or something that scrolls across the web page to say that you know, you're trying to find information on that website is just like, you know, I'm not looking for the old TV show somewhere, something like that. But I think I think they need to use more banners on their web page or something to, you know, alert people to that committee, you know, message. And then just highlight it. Just, you know, just come up with a color code or something like that. And these are the items that we're going to focus on. If you want to make comments, well, we're going to address those particular comments. Just, you have a beautiful website. Just, you know, I just think it needs to be maybe kind of redesigned, you know, so that people know where to go to find the information. And then just hone in on what, if you have one or two items on here that you'd like people to comment on, highlight that, and I think it would work.
Thank you, Sharon. It's a very good point. You know, I know that right now when the agenda goes up, it just sort of goes up quietly. There's not, you know, so maybe there could be a way for people to sign up on the site to get an email. Like right now they have that press release email that's super timeline. They even have an agendas email that anyone can sign up and can say the agenda has now been posted. And then on the agenda page, for any item that wants comment, you could have a little link right there that says, you know, do you have comments about this item, or a little box. And so then you see, you know, number two, you know, whether to paint the trains all blue, you know, do you want this or not, you know, or whatever. And, you know, also consider some organizations then, like COG, publishes sometimes the comments, or people can opt to be private or not private, but to have those comments published, you know, to sort of make it more clear that members have heard the comments, you could have a section to see all the other comments that have been submitted on this item or something to that effect.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that when we're looking at making sure things on the website are meeting certain accessibility requirements, I'm sure that your folks either follow accessibility requirements from the Access Board on Section 508 or ADA, one of those groups. Certainly, I think my committee would be sensitive and happy to assist as far as helping to evaluate some of that stuff. I know that I've seen some documents on the websites that are sometimes not accessible when you have graphical PDFs and things like that. So it's just something to keep in mind, and using the Disability Committee as a resource to help improve accessibility on the site for everybody is maybe a good thing to keep in mind.
I was going to say, just for perhaps each agenda item on the website, just maybe in italics underneath, put public comments welcome. If it's an agenda item that you don't want comments, public comments not welcome. But then also for those, I mean, they have to do that for each one. If you want it, you don't want it. If you want it, you don't want it. And then for those that you do want, I'd actually also put the number of comments received.
like, sometimes I'll be on the Washington Post, and I'll say, oh, this article really says this, I don't want this, and then I'll see 274 comments, whoa, maybe I need to read this, and I still read comments, and I don't care. But, you know, if you, other people know that other folks are commenting, they may be more inclined to leave a comment as well.
I was going to echo something like that. I don't have specific things, but just look at newspapers and blogs, because there's so much of social networking that allows for this current communication, and people are getting used to doing it in all of the forms. I have Carl, and then Steve.
I think David's comment is an excellent one, and the Regional Transit Authority is where I'm from. Sound Transit in the Seattle area provides excellent updates that you can sign up for that are not just when board meetings are happening and agenda items and things, but they do a weekly CEO report that summarizes what's going on and issues, and I forwarded them to John before to show them. It's a very good way to staying up to date to what's going on in the system, and it actually makes you feel like the system cares about communicating with the public. Not that it doesn't, but you know.
It helps, right? And then Dawn, and then we're going to have to move on. Oh, Deborah, sorry.
Yeah, I would echo Frank's point about social media and thinking not only a website that is providing in-depth information, but also all the other avenues on the web to get information, such as Twitter, such as Facebook, and just a Twitter account, Metro Board, where we're inviting your public comments. And then the link, you click there. I mean, it's just, the web is so interactive and so growing that just take advantage of all the opportunities where people that are interested can get that information in a very quick, efficient way.
I think these are all good comments, but getting back to the issue of public comment, Metro as an entity is not one that is open. So again, you know, when I was visiting Toronto last summer, there were signs prominently posted in both stations and on subway cars saying that the federal government, the province of Ontario, and Toronto Transit Commission were replacing their Red Rockets, which is what they're named for their streetcars, and they want input at every phase. And so when an agenda item comes to the committee and ultimately to the board, it should have incorporated public comment, and you know, to the extent that it's not just holding a workshop, but it's maybe giving up some advertising space on your trains and in your stations to let people know that, you know, they're taking comment, and to have a process that incorporates comment from the earliest period. My best example is last year, Jim Henry, who, by the way, does a great job, came to us with a new bus sign that was, okay, this is it. Do you have any comments? And I said, well, what about something in Braille? And there was a compromise, and at least the bus stop number is now provided in Braille. However, that's not the way it should work, and everything from interiors of rail cars to interiors of buses to designs of bus signs is something where the management should basically work to incorporate public comment so that when they bring something to you, it's already being commented on if it's important to the writer. And so this, what you're talking about here, should be the end phase of a public participation process, not the only phase of public participation.
And then the restriction on a lot of personnel things that are not personnel related and, you know, or in litigation or have to do with contracts. So those are really the two changes that were made relative to comment at board meetings. We didn't really discuss any other particular changes that have been involved at the moment.
Those are the two main restrictions, right?
And we tried to streamline it a little bit, too, in terms of, you know, getting rid of some of these things, like who gives who the money and all that sort of stuff. So,
yeah, I was going to say I just agree with both of those removing restrictions for.
Can I bring up a question that's not really directly related to this list, but that came up in the public comment? And I know that the bylaws cover the JCC, mm-hmm. and whether those meetings are open to the public or not. And I was just wondering, for my clarification, because I've never tried to attend one of these meetings anyway, I have too many already. Were those meetings in the past open to the public? Has that changed? Or is there a reason why they're not?
Well, I'm going to start, and Carol O'Keefe, our lawyer, can correct me if I did this wrong, and Kathy can jump in. We actually had a little bit of we had a lot of conversation about this. Here's my understanding. The JCC was established in the 80s, and it was established as a way for the jurisdictional staff to talk to the WMATA staff with the purpose of letting the technical people have the technical conversation so that the jurisdictional people could go back and work with their jurisdictional reps so that they would be well prepared for the board meetings. The other purpose was that the jurisdictional staff could bring in jurisdictional issues that WMATA staff might have missed in their focus on the big thing and not thought through how it might affect Arlington or Alexandria or Montgomery or whatever. So they were really established to facilitate this exchange of information staff to staff. That's my understanding from the people that I've talked to. Over time, there have been more people who come. One of the things in the original enabling resolution says there's only 9 members. It's a lot more than 9 members. The FTA comes, the governors come, and there's a lot of governmental people. But they really do kind of get into things which are, you know, there's a lot of push and shove, and it's a free-flowing, as I understand it, I'm going to get a technical conversation. Over time, I believe that there was one citizen who was allowed to attend. And once he was allowed to attend, the media began to want to attend. And it was in that conversation of, is this an open meeting to which anyone can come, and where the media could take the push and shove and turn it into stories that might in fact not reflect where the board was going to work or what management's recommendations were going to be. The question came up of, well, like, what really was the purpose? And going back and thinking about it and quite honestly wanting, as a jurisdictional person, to get the best technical advice that I possibly can from the people who work for Arlington and as a new person, needing to rely on that as I am learning. And I think that was kind of the sense of the rest of us, was we need that technical staff support to be free-flowing and open on this conversation, and we don't need the TV crews there taping it as things are being formulated. So that's my 2 cents. I hope I haven't gone a direction.
No, that's a perfect summary. The issue did come up a couple of years ago, and I did research in terms of,
This is Carol O'Keefe. If you don't know, she's the general counsel for the board and the agency.
Anyway, I just wanted to add to, I think, a very complete and perfect summary. When the issue arose a few years ago, I researched the resolution that there were actually a couple of resolutions in the last class of 1983, that established and made permanent the JCC. There was nothing in the resolution itself that addressed whether or not the JCC would be open to the public or not. And consequently, I did an analysis at that time that focused on what the JCC was for based upon the description in the resolution. And I concluded at that time that it was intended to be an extended staff meeting. And for all purposes, the business science as described. And I think when you appreciate and understand what the purpose is, you can also understand why that would not be appropriate to be open to the public. And again, fortunately, when you open it to one member, it inevitably you will have to open it to everyone. So I don't think it was a specific concern about the individual who is very interested in the matter more than the broader implications.
The only other thing that I would add, and I agree with what's been said so far, the only other thing I would add is that what sometimes tends to happen is if you have press people at those meetings, they interpret the discussion that's going on as sort of something that the board is going to decide. And in fact, you know, those are staff people who are advising their board members. They're not the people who make the decisions. And the decisions made by the board members at the board meeting. And what, as a board member, I would hate to have happen is walk into a board meeting, and have the press already announcing that a decision has been made based on a staff discussion when the board hasn't actually decided yet.
I'm going to let David Albert, who shepherded us through the report, have the final comment.
I didn't really have a comment about governance. I just wanted to say it was really great to have this conversation with you. And in the time I've been on the RAC, there have been few, if any, times when we've had two board members sort of sit here and spend this much time with us and really ask us questions and take detailed notes and seem extremely interested in, you know, our input on a number of issues. Not that board members haven't been interested in our input on a number of issues, but you know, having this level of kind of conversation has been really wonderful. I really appreciate both of you coming to discuss this with us and for all your work on the governance in general. Thank you.
And what I'd like to say in response that you set the stage for that by giving us very thoughtful comments on governance to start with. Thank you.
Your presence and interaction really model the type of openness that we see. So thank you very, very much. Always know that you're always welcome.
So we have our notes. I'm sure others around the table have their notes. John's been taking notes. I really did mean what I said at the beginning, which is this can be the opening, or if you feel like this is sufficient and we've gotten the gist of it, we'll take it back and share it with everybody. It's really your call. And so if you want to provide us some letter in writing or something else, as to what the things you accomplished in this. So it's up to you, but we both have a page and a half of notes, so.
Okay,
I'm glad you're willing to do that. I didn't realize we were only covering these topics. I had some other general comments about what you've been working on, so I will work through John to follow up with that because I didn't realize we didn't have time to talk about that generally.
I'm sorry.
No problem. We're running late already.
Yes, and you please do feel free. Any of the rest of you who have other things that we didn't get a chance to talk about, please just send an email or work it through the rack, and we'll take it out
and share with everybody else. Thanks very much. Thank you. Okay, we're going to move on to the discussion of the public hearings and budget discussions at FY 2012. If you will turn to page 49 and 74.
We just thought it would be good to see that there's coverage, encourage all MAC members to attend at least one of these public hearings. So thought it might be good to take a few minutes just to see who's going to what, and if there are any questions or comments, particularly from the members. Last year, and we're going to try for it this year, last year RAC members were identified at the public hearings so that people, not so much that, not necessarily that people would then come to you and say they're there at the public hearing and they're there to speak to the board, but that at least they know about the RAC and a way of letting anyone know about us. So maybe first thing we'll do is just go through and see if there's coverage of all the meetings. Anyone going to the Prince George's meeting, 5R6, I will be there.
I will be there too, but can I ask you?
Oh, okay. Sure.
I guess, and I want to say this while I'm trying to sit here, is that on this flyer in general, and maybe on another copy of this flyer, is that maybe it should include metrically accessible ways to get to these meetings, since it's a metro meeting, and so, and you know, for that, when I go downtown, I remember a lot of groups, and there's always meeting downtown, they're always saying, take this metro stop to get here, and so, if we could have a flyer or something put up on, I know how to get to the meeting in Hinesville, but if this is on the board outside a metro station, someone else might not know necessarily how to get there. So, if we can do something with this to make it include a naturally accessible ways to get to all of these meetings, that probably would be helpful.
We actually do have that. We have something similar to this that actually has the, this is the legal notice. So we're sort of constrained by the format of what we're allowed to put in. We have a poster that's going out on buses and trains that includes, and on the website, and I'll send that to you. The flyer will just have the closest rail station because you can't get too detailed, and we've chosen all these to be very close to rail stations if possible because they're transit hubs.
To, like, bus line that might go there to you.
Right. We have a separate document that is up on the website, and I'll make sure that you get it, that also includes all the bus lines that not only serve that rail station, but in some cases, you know, it's a 3-block walk from the rail station to the hearing site. It's at the front door is a bus line. So there's information in that. So yes, but then you make an excellent point. That's what I was. Actually, Deborah has the ad right there. Right, but it lists the rail stations.
Okay, number the Tuesday, May 17th in Alexandria. The Alexandria one. Is anyone coming? Steven? Jamie?
Mount
Vernon? Mount Vernon, yeah. Okay, great. The other May 17th one in Washington, D.C. Is someone there? David Lippertz? The Arlington one on May 18th, if any, and learning. Wednesday, May 18th in Wheaton, Maryland. And May 19th in D.C.
Great.
May I ask, why
isn't
there anything in Fairfax?
Yeah, it's
true.
Did
you spend two in each jurisdiction?
Do you know why you didn't do Fairfax? No, there's two in the two in the
Can I answer? Okay. Can I answer that question?
Sure.
Can I
try to answer?
Not a, I'm thinking that it's not medical accessible, but don't do that anything away from the
Yeah, Deborah's right. It's a combination of things. Since the only service reductions for people in Virginia that are on the table are rail service reductions, and there are essentially two lines in Virginia. The orange line goes west, the blue and yellow lines go south. We've got one here on the orange line, we've got one here on the blue and yellow lines, and they're both accessible at the stations. Whereas in D.C. there's some bus service and some fare changes, and so that speaks to the French Heights and the passenger locations. And it's in, you're right, in Fairfax there aren't as many places immediately adjacent to the rail stations that are public hearings.
Your public hearings change every time. Last time,
Montgomery
County, one was Rockville.
Yeah.
So,
they move around. Okay. Go out and listen to the public and get your impressions. Anything else?
Do you mind if I just.
Oh, sure.
Penny had asked if there's any kind of budget update that we can give at this point. And I just, the only thing, you know, I guess what's still on the table, and I thought I had included it in the packet now that I looked them up, it's page 70 of 74. Penny asked what's still on the table aside from the service cuts to help balance the budget, and have there been any changes to the budget outlook, and do we know whether or not jurisdictions will be able to pony up sort of all of their additional subsidies that the general manager had asked for. The answer to the first question, or I guess the first thing, is that our gap has narrowed by about $6 million. Because the economy is improving and the job outlook is improving, we're expecting about $4 million in additional revenue from increased ridership next year. And we've had about a $2 million cut in expenses projected for next year. So we're $6 million closer. So we went from about a $72 million budget gap to about a $66 million budget gap. Do we know whether or not the jurisdictions will be able to fully fund that? No. Nothing official. I know that some jurisdictional representatives have said that they might be able to do that, but it's not unanimous and it's not official. And then the other funding options that are still on the table are these three, where we would take a lump sum payment for our ground leases. We would essentially transfer $30 million out of our capital budget into lease property maintenance means. And we would, we're in the midst of a arbitration with our union, and we're required to put the money in the bank to pay for that in case we lose, essentially. And we're getting closer to a final decision on that. And so we have that money saved up, and it's possible to reuse that if we don't need to. The one thing that has been taken off the table is station name rights. So there's not going to be Delaware Chinatown brought to you by Verizon. So that's off. But these other funding options are still on the table for the board to at least consider the year.
Thank you, John. Okay. Let's go on to questions and comments on the RAC chair and the AAC chair reports. So I apologize for not getting mine out until late this afternoon.
Can I?
If there are any questions, John, I don't know if you.
It's being passed out as you speak. So if you want to hit the highlights.
I'm stalling for time here. So Frank, you did a better job. Mine was running at 6:15.
Governance Committee meeting to continue the discussion about the process by which we request information and information goes back and forth with the board, which I think Penny sort of updated you all on the previous discussion at last month's meeting. And that will be 1 week from today. So we'll send out information about that. But we'll continue that discussion then.
Thank you. There were no committee meetings this month, which is why we don't have any committee reports. So if there are any questions, on AAC or RAC reports?
And the other thing I would say, Frank, on the items that I covered briefly in my report is we're starting to do a better job now of tracking what the customers have to say, and I think we saw a little bit of that discussed in the governance area. We have three committees, the main committee and two subcommittees, one on bus and rail, one on metro access. Rather than just take customer comments now, we're going to be starting to look and get back to our customers and track the results of what their comments are, which I think is going to be new and different. Also, the extension for the metro access, which was a position that we took, contract to exercise the final option, a two-year option, was exercised, and that goes into the contract will go until 2013. We're going to be looking at, my committee is going to be looking at putting comments together for a request for information, which we hope will finally get into the request for proposal, which will be down the line. So we'll have input into the new metro access contract, essentially. And then lastly, on Thursday, now, tomorrow, geez, between 2 and 3:30 in this room, there's going to be a meeting with stakeholders concerning the eligibility process and how we want to deal with those individuals that have multiple disabilities and may need assistance. WMATA last year made a policy decision which basically came back to bite them. And a lot of groups got together, particularly those that were cognitively impaired, and said they were being too restrictive. We're getting a group of people together this year. The policy has been put on hold and reversed. And so we want to get a lot of the stakeholders, particularly those individuals that use metro access, who want to use metro access, but who may need some assistance because of cognitive impairments, come up with a policy that's not a restricted group of people from taking it, but also keep everybody in the system safe that uses it. So that'll be 2 to 3:30 tomorrow afternoon in this room, and it'll be an open meeting.
Thank you, Patrick. Any? Sure.
Just a quick update on bus committee. We're not meeting this month, but because we want everyone to go to the hearings and concentrate on other things like budget. But John and I are going to be working on a summary to share with the bus committee next month in June, and then also share with the board on the work of the bus committee and the themes over the past couple of years, because we have so many new board members, we thought that might be helpful. We also have some board members that are new that are keenly interested in bus issues. So that's what John and I are going to work on this month.
The next item on the agenda is audio and video recording of council meetings. We deferred this twice because of time restrictions, and we have a few minutes if people want to discuss it, some of it tonight. But once again, the person who requested this topic is unable to be here tonight. There is in your packet, this very last page, someone who last month submitted a written comment on this policy. Patrick, I'm going to call.
Thank you. It's interesting. This one just went right past me, so Frank, I might need some more clarification on this. But one of the areas that ADAP staff is looking at and talking to WMATA about is, if you're going to have video and audio communication of meetings, you're going to have to meet some accessibility requirements, whether they fall under Section 508 of the ADA. Some of those requirements are going to be rather expensive as it applies to captioning for open meetings, live captioning, and also captioning of some of the content. So there are going to be some specific accessibility requirements. I see them in the federal government because they do 508 work for VA.
If I could just interrupt, I should have explained better. what this topic is. I know it, and so this is a topic, and I respect that and I appreciate your feedback on that. This, this topic was brought up by Carol Harder Walker, basically because at our meeting, our special meeting, committee meeting on the bag searches, someone was videoing, a private citizen was video recording the meeting. And and so there, now our meetings have always been open to the public, our meetings have always been open to the press, but Carol, and I wish you were here to speak about concern myself, but I'll try to represent it as best as possible. Carol's concern was private citizens recording the meeting and then using that video elsewhere for unknown purposes. And she wanted to bring it up for discussion. So, but what if we would set a policy about video and audio recording of our meetings by private citizens, basically, not by the press.
And not by
Vermont. And not by Vermont. So, I have Carl, Joseph, Victoria, and David. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh.
My comment is twofold. First, I guess I don't see the necessity of why people would need to do this because the audio is already posted online and it is a public meeting. So I guess I'm not sure as to why anyone would feel the need to generate their own audio recording when we have the official version that is being generated that is available in the public. As to the video question, we obviously aren't, you know, being taped, though I don't think it is out of line for this body to ask people to sign in if they plan to sign in with their name, organization, that sort of thing, if they plan to videotape. I don't see a problem with that. And that should also be noted in our minutes as well. This person filmed from the Sierra Club. Mm-hmm. If it's all public record, then it should all be public record. So, if we're going to discuss anything, I think time in this can be appropriate if we're going to continue to allow our video on it.
I have Joseph, Victoria, Chris, Ron, Deborah, and Penny, and David. Oh, Kelsey and David.
Frank, I guess the first time I'm really hearing about this is through this letter, and so reading this letter, I guess apparently we've been advised by the General Counsel to create something. Is that
what happened was that when there was there had been a request for recording that the committee meeting, there is no written policy about it. So there was some discrepancy and so John asked the General Counsel, who said that there, you know, the meetings are open to the public, but there's no policy. So if this is an issue, we should develop a policy. But we don't have to develop a policy, but then we are open to ambiguity in some way.
I guess my thing is, I guess if someone wants to develop a policy, then I think that they should develop it and they should bring it and we will consider it then. But I don't see the need for a policy. I think that we are a public body. We are a public body. People who want to come in and record video or audio, as long as it's not destructive or distractive to the meeting, should be allowed to do that. And that includes, you know, registered members of the press, individual bloggers, people who just got off the train that day, because that's what we all decided we wanted to do when we asked our appointing authorities to appoint us to this board. And I understand, I kind of understand, not I guess I kind of understand why we might want to feel the need to control some of that information, but I've served on the planning commission before. I've served on a number of governmental bodies before. It's not something that any of them had at the time. It was not something that, you know, I guess we're different. We're not elected. We're not elected individuals. We would like to maintain some of our individual autonomy. But when I think that, you know, the day we said we wanted this position, then I think that we opened ourselves up to be in the public role in our comments and things that we say and the votes that we take, they are public. And so it's, since they are public, then we really, I think that setting up the barrier of having someone sign in or any other obstacle for someone to come jump through, I think that the more barriers you set up, I think that you limit public participation that way. So that's why I can, off the grid, I can tell you I couldn't support it. I would never support it unless there was a justifiable reason why we needed that information. And right now, I can't hear why we needed that information except for we might have it.
Thank you. And just let me say, too, just to clarify, this is not a recommendation that we are making or that the executive committee is making. This is what we're having now is really just an open discussion about how, if and how we want to pursue establishing this policy. Victoria.
I would say, just some more background, this really came up because at one of our meetings a couple of months ago, we had several people here. There was the press, there was someone else taping, there were pictures going on, so it was getting pretty shocking. It was just, it hit the head at one meeting. But yeah, I also don't understand, too, why a part of the system would want to have a stockpile of rap videos. I don't get it. Does that mean we shouldn't let them? But I think that since we offer so many other ways for them to get the information, that they should have to sign in and tell us what. It's just simple, like, who are you, what are you doing with it? Not that we'll ever say, no, you can't do it, but yeah, I guess I just don't understand why people are reusing it, why there's a need for that.
Chris?
Yeah, I would just offer a couple of comments. One, I'd echo what Joseph said. I mean, we knowingly undertook a public role in being here. Secondly, although I understand the comments about not understanding why someone would want to do something like that, it's actually not our business to decide why someone else would want to do something. If they are coming here for legitimate reasons and aren't interfering with what's going on, who knows what they want it for? They may redistribute it in a way that would help us, that may redistribute it in a way that would not be so helpful, but it's really not our call to make. And finally, as a practical matter, I don't see how we could ever do anything like this, only because, for example, we make the case that journalists are okay. Well, journalists are not a special class legally. Journalists are just other private citizens. And so were we to do anything that discriminates, and I don't mean that in the racial or ethnic sense, but if we did anything that discriminated among different members of or classes of the public, we would very quickly be on very shaky ground. So I really see no need for this, and I suggest that we just put it off until there's a more compelling reason.
Deborah.
I think one
disruptive to the meeting, that's fine.
And if they are being disrupted, giving them that feedback and so that they can make some sort of adjustment to their behavior, if they're, you know, running around in circles filming or something like that, they can make an adjustment and still be able to continue if they're not being disruptive. I'd also say that someone, an individual, might be recording for an accommodation reason. I've worked with advocates that have cognitive impairments that were transit advocates, and they actually needed to record meetings to remember various parts of the meetings and to be fully engaged in the advocacy process. So that's another reason why a private citizen might report.
You mean they needed a video, not the audio that John has?
Well, they might have, I don't know, they might have needed it sooner, for example, or something like that. I mean, I know it's good that we make audio available as well, but I'm just trying to think of another reason why a private citizen, in addition to, you know, putting it out to the public, might want to record it for themselves, just like students, you know, might record a course or something like that, because they're trying to remember and keep track, and if, you know, it's just something that I've observed before with other transit properties, so I thought I'd share that.
We'll see.
Yeah, I was going to say that whether a policy requirement needs to be established or not, I'm not definitely clear on that just yet, but I feel that there is an official medium to get out what we're saying to the public through our audio recordings, through our minutes. I also feel like I find that when the press is here or when a private citizen is here recording, I find it to be distracting and to take away from the work that I'm trying to do here, because although I'm not trying to look at them, when there was one guy who was right here in the middle, I thought he was shooting a movie or something, so I do find that to be distracting. It also concerns me because I think there are some of us that have, while we applied for this position and we knew that it was going to be public, I don't think it was made apparent to us that there could be private citizens recording our actions or our moves, that perhaps to some of us in here they have the intent to just use it to record for meeting purposes, but behind closed doors doing something else with it when things going viral. Not saying we have any control over that, but we don't know, and there are certainly some of us that may come from backgrounds or vulnerable situations where we don't need anyone additional using that information. Not saying anyone has a horrible intent, but you never know, and I think that sometimes when you have certain people that are single, maybe don't have, you know, just looking at it from that standpoint, maybe not having family or someone else to look out for their best interests. And so I would ask that if we have someone who is a private citizen here recording, that we definitely have a name, an address, a number, a contact information, so that if we feel we've been misrepresented in some way, that video has been used, just like with the press, we can get back in touch with them quickly. Or again, should it escalate to something legal, that we can do that instead of having just someone walks in, take a picture, take a video, and then walks out.
Thank you, Ron.
Actually, I was going to say something along the lines that you just said. That is, I know we're a public organization. I certainly would not try to choose who has a right to hear what we say and who doesn't have a right to say, but every organization I've ever been with, including the federal government, exercises some degree of control. And I don't see any reason, you know, we are an organization, we have a public comment meeting at the beginning. We don't let people make public comments during the middle of our meetings. We do control our agenda, we control our meetings. I don't see any reason why we can't say that somebody who wants to record us has to first check in, I guess, maybe with you, and has to give us their name and address and maybe some indication of why they're recording it, whether it's for personal use or TV, what channel, whatever. Because again, every organization I've been with, including the federal government, exercises some degree of control over meetings. And I see this as just flowing from that. Again, I'm not choosing who gets to do it or cutting anybody off. But again, I think we have a right to organize and control our meetings.
I have David and Stephen.
I guess I'm on the kind of associate myself with the Joseph and company side of this discussion. We don't ask people who come in to listen to the meeting to identify themselves, and we don't know what the people who are over there are going to go and tell other people that they heard about what we said. And you you know, that's not our business what they're thinking about our meeting, and we put the audio online, and we don't ask people to tell us why they're listening to our audio online or what they're going to use it for, and if they're going to misuse it for any purpose we might conceive of. The people who are recording our meeting, what they did was they recorded they cut it into short video clips, mostly of the responses from Chief Taborn and the other police people that were at the earlier hearing. And one of the things that is in our meetings, this is not just us, it's officials of Metro, board members or people who head up different sections. And I think it advances our public purpose if we are hearing testimony from people who are Metro officials, to make it easier for other people or other riders to know about what those people said. And sometimes video is a much more effective way to do that. So I think that we should, if we're going to establish a policy, I think our policy should be that recording is permitted as long as it's not disrupting the meeting or, you know, interfering with our ability to conduct it. We could potentially ask if we wanted to. We may be divided, but if we wanted to, we could ask John to work with the general counsel to formulate some language around that, if that was what people wanted to do.
Stephen? Yeah, I would like to echo the similar comments of Joseph and Chris and David and Alvin. If someone wanted to surreptitiously tape meeting, and we're in 2011, every single phone is a video recording device, and there's no enforcement mechanism we could do if someone does it, we're not aware of it, puts it online. There's no way to control it. So I would say that, plus if there's an issue of personal safety, and someone's recording stuff for reasons that has nothing to do with Metro, I think we could find ways to approach that person and find out what's going on and handle it a different way without a formal videotaping policy that we can't really enforce anyway.
Just two quick comments.
I also want to make sure we think about the public comment period. People are uncomfortable with recording, if we haven't done that in the past. That also may hinder people in that aspect. And completely forgot my other comment. I guess I don't see the difference. Since we do have people signing for public comment, I don't think it would be that much of an imposition to have someone sign in because they're recording, because they're doing something of that nature. We do already have people sign in for public comment.
Can I ask a question? Can we possibly ask John if Metro has a policy, get that policy, and look at that policy? If they don't have a policy, then there you go. I haven't heard any uproar over Metro's policy. Modeling our policy, if we come up with one next to Metro, might be best. Because I think that any time you go into this realm, you open yourself up for a lawsuit. And that's not our role. The last thing we want to do is be people who open Metro up to a lawsuit.
I think that what we're going to, the best way to proceed here now, as I said, this agenda item was just a discussion, not to develop policy, to see if there was energy around that and where that energy was going, is I think I'm going to ask Carol, who was the original initiator of this, to review our comments that were made and to see where she would like to go, and then also to see if, as David said and as Joseph said, maybe to pursue the Office of General Counsel offering us some guidance in this, and maybe it will come forward as a motion, and we can then vote and discuss and vote on that. So I'm going to call the meeting adjourned. Thank you for your patience.
Thanks, Kelsey.
I got your email. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. And I didn't have a chance. I should have asked Jim. And he was the person I needed to ask, and I didn't get a chance to do that today, so I'll follow up with him.
Okay, tomorrow. You have to get something out of the
way. Yeah, I'm sure somebody knows. I just have to figure out who that is.
Okay. Thank you.
I can stop this.